All right, we are started.
Order this day, Thursday, October 22nd. Can you call attendance, please, Natalie?
Archer?
Here.
Wrong. Bartels? She was here.
I still see her name.
Yeah. Gavaris?
Present.
And Haynes?
Here.
Mayo? And Walter?
Here.
Thank you.
Great. All right, thank you all for joining us today. I know there's been some confusion out there since we had such a late start in 2020 with all the budget concerns, and some of you are still sorting out contract details. What we're here to talk about tonight are your applications for 2021. And I think Natalie prepared you to speak for about 5 minutes and then be prepared for questions. So I just wanted to acknowledge some of the things going on with the contract. The other is it's been a really unusual year for everyone. And I'm sure your agencies have experienced a lot of things. And so I'm hoping you can share some of that with us tonight. And in your talk, talk about how your organization supports the community, what you're looking for 2021 funding and what it's going to be used for. And any data or statistics that you can share would be very helpful as well. So I think we have an order here, and I believe people's place, Christine Hind goes first. You're on mute, Christine.
I know, I just had to unmute me. I'm sorry. I was like trying to figure it out. So thank you for taking the time and allowing me to speak about People's Place. People's Place is located in Kingston, but it does serve all of Ulster County. And we are in our 48th year of operation. I think what we're most well known for is the food pantry, and that and super crazy busy. It's been trending higher, but with COVID, it really, really exploded in the end of March, April, May, June, July. I have to say, I am phenomenally proud of my volunteers and the very small staff that we have. No one ever stopped coming because of COVID. Nobody ever said, I can't do it. We did have to tell volunteers finally that we're over 70 because of the Matilda law that they couldn't come any longer. And some of them have started to come back now. But we have given out our increase of over 300% in April, May, June, and then 100% in July. And now it's kind of leveled off to the same amount of folks. But we also are one of the organizations that help distribute groceries to homebound individuals and households. And we work with Kingston Emergency Food Collaboration with that. And we never closed from... Ever since COVID started, we have maintained our normal daily operations and continue to help individuals within all of Ulster County for help. We have a long history of helping individuals and families in all avenues of need, not just food, but we do Project Santa, which is a gigantic toy distribution. And sometimes people go, oh, who needs toys? But you know, I mean, toys are important. It's going back to school. It's talking to their friends and saying, yes, Santa came to them. We have a birthday booth, which helps provide birthday gift, birthday cake, candles, what I call birthday swag to children when they have their birthday. And that came about from talking to different teachers within the Kingston School District that they know, you know, some kids don't even know it's their birthday because the parents don't tell them because they can't afford to provide them with a birthday cake. So, you know, we have numerous different programs. We have a pet pantry. None of those programs ceased during the COVID pandemic. we're still open. We have instituted very strict COVID guidelines. No one is allowed on our property without a mask. They have to sign in order to come into the thrift store. We take their name, their phone number in case we have to do tracing, which is another, I actually hired a part-time person to do that because I couldn't find a volunteer that would come every single day that we were open to do it. We take temperatures for everybody who comes in. So we're really practicing all of the guidelines that are set up by the New York State Health Department to make sure that people stay safe, but still get the services that they need. So the help that the county can provide to us will help us continue to operate. You know, it just helps us breathe a little easier. It helps us provide numerous services, sort of all goes into a big pool, and you know, just to help us continue providing the services. Just as an FYI, so far this year, we've helped and handed out over what would equate to over 800,000 meals. It's over 750,000 meals just out of our location. I mean, and there are other not-for-profits in our area and in the Kingston area that are helping feed individuals also. So, you know, it's a huge problem in our area, but it's a huge problem all across the country. Hunger is not specific to Ulster County. It's all across our nation. And the fact that we have helped over 800 or provided over 800,000 meals just in 2020. That's a huge increase from last year. And we still have all of November, which is, has our Thanksgiving program. We have all of December, which has Bag Holiday Hunger in it. You know, when COVID started, one of the things that I'm most proud about my staff and my volunteers are that school closed on a Thursday. On Monday morning, we were handing out bags of breakfast, lunch, and snack foods to households that have school-age children. We did not miss a beat. And we just provided the food and said, you know, it'll come. And we did that for 26 weeks straight.
Great. Okay, any questions? No questions. Okay. I have one. Can you, do you break it down by, I see your hand up now. Thank you. Do you break it down by, you say you serve all of Ulster County. Do you have a breakdown of, you know, where the meals were served and, you know, what percentage, you know, each town made up of that 800,000 meals?
I really don't. I mean, we could pull it and we could try to figure out. Our computer program just puts everybody into one computer system. And just for our statistics, we don't pull that. We could probably try to figure that out. I would say a large portion of them come from what I call the Kingston area, the city of Kingston, Lake Katrine, the surrounding areas, also Ellenville. And we have worked very closely with Ellenville Central School District to provide meals to the students out in Ellenville. There actually are people who come from Ellenville School District and come and pick up, and they did it all year since COVID started, all summer long. And they've done this for the last couple of years and picked up the bags, student hunger bags. They also come and pick up the Thanksgiving program that we do. And they also come and pick up Project Santa and Bag Student Hunger. So I can tell you, I know that that's about 300, 330 families in Ellenville that we help. And the only reason I know that for a fact is we're dealing with them now, and they're sending us their registrations for the holidays.
Right. Legislative Walter.
Thanks, and Legislator Haynes also had her hand up. I guess, one of my questions related to that of just sort of knowing how many people are being served really outside of Kingston as well. It'd be good to have a sense of that information. I also was wondering if you could talk about, I have two things. One, of what other sources of funding you have? And then the second one is, could you give us an idea of like what $10,000 buys you, you know, maybe in the number of meals you can provide with it, or just so I have a better sense of what that amount of money sort of gets to the people who are in need.
Sure. So, okay. So as far as the number of people served that live outside of Kingston, like I said, our program doesn't do that. But I will say we are doing delivery still. And a portion of those folks do not live in Kingston. They live in town of Ulster. They live in Lake Katrine. They live in Woodstock. And I just know those because every week we pack those bags. So I see all of the addresses. We have people in Highland. We have people in Esopus. So those are true, easily validated addresses. We also work with somebody down in Marlborough that has about, which we only just started, about 100 households that we're helping out down in the Marlborough area. And they come and they pick up and they'll be bringing them down there. You asked, oh, $10,000. Our money kind of goes into a pool and then we, a pool, you know, into the bookkeeper, and then she divides it out. But I can tell you that I would say $10,000 is easily over 10,000 meals. Because our meals don't average a dollar a meal. And there was another part of the question, which I forgot. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Just what other sources of funding do you have?
Sure. So we do fundraisers. This year was a little hard because of COVID, obviously. But the city of Kingston did give us funding because of COVID. And that was the first time we've gotten funding for operational costs through the city of Kingston. So that was a nice extra for this year. I don't expect it for 2021 because it's not something that is, you know, historically something that we get. I apply for any grant that I can possibly find. So I apply for grants through the Community Foundation. I apply for grants through Key Bank. You know, anytime there's some kind of funding out there, we put an application out. We don't get it all the time, and sometimes we do get some.
Can you just ballpark on average how much other funding you do get a year?
How much other funding we get a year? Prior to 2020, because of COVID, because we have gotten COVID money. I mean, it's all on the record. We've gotten $60,000 from the city of Kingston for COVID. And prior to that, we usually get, I'm going to say about $180,000 of funding through grants prior to 2020.
Thank you.
Yeah, and then of course, like I just mentioned previously, we did get the $60,000 for COVID from the city of Kingston, and we applied for a community development block grant, which we were granted, but we haven't gotten that money yet.
Legislator Haynes.
Yes, Christine. Hi, it's good to see you, even though it's virtually. It's been a bit. Nonetheless, I'd like to start by saying I am a bit familiar with your organization, so thank you for the hard work that you do. My question's been answered a little bit, but I just want to clarify further. There's no residency requirement. If anyone came to the People's Place for help, I believe there's two parts. There's no residency requirement, and I know for your fresh farmers market, there's also no income guideline. Is that correct? You don't ask for any documentation for that?
Right. So here's how we operate. We have certain programs that are just out, like you said, the farmers market. Anybody could technically come to that. We give food. We like to say that we serve anybody in Ulster County. That being said, I will tell you, and I know you're the Ulster County legislators, but if somebody from out of the county comes to us and says they need food, we're not going to turn them away. We're not going to say, I'm sorry, you don't live in Ulster County. We're not going to provide you food. So but it's anyone who lives in Ulster County. So it doesn't have to be Kingston or the greater Kingston area. And I will say where the confusion comes is when I started at People's Place 8.5 years ago, it used to just be the Kingston and the greater Kingston area. And we changed that as a board directive probably 1.5 years after I was there. So for at least a solid 6.5 years, we have been serving all of Ulster County. When people come in, we don't ask for any financial documentation, but we do ask for proof of residency in order to use the food pantry and some of the other programs that we do, the Thanksgiving program, Bag Summer Hunger. We ask if they have a SNAP card or a benefit card. And the reason we do that is, and that doesn't mean that they can't get services. We have people who only have a driver's license or only have some other form of ID, but because we are a member of the food bank, we have to have a certain percentage of folks who are living within a certain economic level.
Legislator Bartels.
Thank you. I know you said that, and in the application, it also speaks to that the money, if you receive money from the county, that it'll go to whatever, wherever there's the most need. And you talked about your bookkeeper just sort of directing the money. I just want to say that, and I think I've said this before, but not as it relates to your organization. Mm-hmm. I feel much more comfortable as a legislator if we are funding a specific program. Some of the listings, and it, we had this with another organization where we had a discussion related to something similar to what you call Project Santa, just being specific to one religion. I know Santa has become maybe not so religious, but it's arguably in one religion. And so
Santa is not religious.
I personally would feel much more comfortable if we knew which program we would actually be funding. And I'm not asking you to make a distinction right now, but it's something that I'd, if you came back to us, that you could say, this is where this money's going to go. It's going to fund this. It's going to bolster this, and it's going to have this effect.
We have 22 programs that we do that help folks who are financially, neighbors who are struggling financially. Mm-hmm. So that would not be a difficult thing to place those funds to a certain program.
So again, it's something you could come back to us with, but
we'll go ahead, Natalie, if you can annotate that, and then we'll have her come back to you and we'll get the information specifically.
Yeah, I also just wanted to mention her 2020 contract was written in a way that it had nothing to do with Christmas. It was only written to fund the food items.
Okay, and that's what this is this targeting that as well? No, this targets multiple So let's be more specific, and we'll follow back up with you for your feedback. Legislator Gavaris.
You mentioned difficulties in fundraising, but then you also mentioned the money you would receive from City of Kingston. Do you know where you are in your net budget or year to date, where you are in that budget?
We're flat.
Okay. So the $60,000 didn't really help much because you lost about that, you're saying, in fundraising.
Right. Okay. We had five fundraisers scheduled, and we were able to do one. And then we did do a virtual one. But virtual is virtual.
Okay, great. Any other questions? Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
Okay, and next we have community action. And I believe that's Susie Hinchey. Is that right? Or Greg?
Greg and Susie. Okay. I'm gonna just talk for a little bit about our agency. We have been in the community for 55 years. It's our 55th year this August. We too, like Christine was saying, COVID has really stepped up everybody being part of Kingston Resilience, being a part of everything that's going on to continue to serve the needs of the people in our community is paramount. Our services at Community Action entail the Head Start and Early Head Start programs for Ulster County, outreach services for the entire county and Sullivan County, and weatherization and empower services. So our funding is coming from the state and federal governments. We also received a COVID grant that is meant for people that are in COVID pandemic stress, and we can help up to 200% of poverty level people for that. Our normal CSBG poverty level is 125% of poverty or less, and Head Start is usually 100% of poverty or less. And with people that are homeless or incarcerated, those children get higher up on a list to get entered into the program. Of course, Head Start and Early Head Start, like all the other schools, is not as full as it's supposed to be right now due to COVID, but it's starting to climb in our Ellenville and Plattekill and Saugerties and Kingston sites. We did have to close for the temporary moment two classrooms in Roundout due to, you know, a lot of our clients have older students that are in the school district in their home, and they've chosen not to send their kids into a Head Start program at this time. But a lot of stuff is being done also virtually. Weatherization, of course, shut down in March, and Empower services through NYSERDA. And so we were not allowed to get back into people's homes until the about the beginning of July, just after the 4th of July. And that's been a slow creep. As for outreach services, we've been open most of the time. We did have to curtail our services during the heavy time of COVID, where we were open instead of 5 days a week. I want to say it was three and a half days that we were open during the week at all of our sites in Highland, Kingston, and Ellenville. And also our Sullivan site was also open during that time. We've had to do a lot of curtailing of people coming into our Lindsley Avenue office, which is our Kingston site. We haven't allowed people in. We've curtailed a lot of volunteer efforts, but during all that time, we still did. We figured out how to do food distributions and mass distributions and drive-throughs, where we have as little contact with the people in the car as possible. And of course, we put over 200,000 pounds of food in a couple months with the help of the food pantry, the food Bank of the Hudson Valley and the Regional Food Bank. We also were heavy into the grocery bag delivery program with Saugerties, Ellenville, and Kingston for a time when that was going on, along with People's Place and others in that process. So we've really hyped up a lot of work that we're doing. As it relates to 2021 funding, all the funding that we've asked the legislature for is to help people with rentals and utilities. Additional people. In 2019, I think we were able to help 12 families, six with rentals, six with utilities, that totaled $9,000. In this request for 2020, we requested obviously more, and it was cut in half, and that was publicized in all the papers. And I guess we're waiting for our paperwork and all that stuff to come through. But in 2021, we're asking for the original request, I believe, of $28,750 that goes to help $18,831 to rentals and utility assistance that we hope to help between 24 and 30 families, depending on what that is. And why this is important to us also is we can use the program service support money from that to help our staff work with people that are outside of the COVID range. If it's not a COVID-related event, this money helps us help them because we do have strict COVID laws with some of the monies we got from the CARES Act. So we're looking forward to the support of the legislature. Susie, do you have anything you want to add?
I just want to say, like, during the COVID time, we saw a large increase of the people needing food. Through our CARES Act, we're able to purchase two vans. So we're going to be delivering hot meals to people that are in need. Our goal is to try to stay open if the second wave comes, Monday through Friday, full-time staff for outreach, and get the food to the people that need it. We've seen a big increase in the rental and utility. And like Greg said, if it's COVID related, which so far that's what it's been, we're able to use the CARES Act, but we have some people coming in that needs the rental that has nothing to do with COVID. And unfortunately, because of the Department of State guidelines, we're not able to assist them. So we do have a little bit of funding that we can use that we did over the years through fundraising that we can use some of that money to help with their utility shutoffs or rentals. But because of COVID, we weren't able to do our fundraising. We usually do a basket bingo where we raise anywhere from $5,000 to $8,000. And I just feel like there's going to be such a great need for the rental and utility. It seems to be two of the major things in Ulster County that the people need.
Any questions?
Great, thank you. Any questions out there? Legislator Gavaris.
It's just more of a statement. I can tell you that the Food Bank of the Hudson Valley, the program that we have, I actually work for Elmville Hospital, we have the pharmacy, which is FARM. That program shut down 209 a few weeks back for about an hour. There was so much need that we have it set up as a drive-through, and the traffic was literally backed up on 209, if you know Ellenville, almost a mile long with people going to get the fresh vegetables. So very good program, very well utilized. So.
We're very happy that Ellenville Regional has partnered with us in Ellenville to be able to assist more people. We also, during COVID, made several meals to the senior center that's over there. I want to say we delivered about 3 times to the seniors there throughout the COVID time. And then also the local pantries, through partnerships, we were able to help supply United Methodist Church, Catholic Charities, Family Woodstock helped out. We had a lot of great partnerships that really has made COVID-19 manageable, is by everyone coming together and figuring out how we serve the community better.
And what's so great is having the regional hospital do the pharmacy. They target, I believe you guys are 4 to 7 or 5 to 7. So it's after our hours. So the working families that aren't able to get to our free outreach locations can go right to Ellenville Regional Hospital on those Thursdays and get fresh fruits and vegetables. So it's like a great partnership we have with them.
It's going on right now as we speak, about maybe 60 feet from my office door.
Great. A little while ago.
It's working. Right. It's working.
Yes. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you for all your hard work this year. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Next, we have Chris the Bardavon.
Thanks, Lynn. Thank you, everybody, for inviting me to join you at this meeting. I do recognize the struggle the county is facing, and really everybody in the world, to make ends meet. Brief history. I started at the Bardavon as executive director in 1994. The theater's been there since 1869. In 1999, we took over the Hudson Valley Philharmonic, the region's only professional symphony orchestra, saving it from bankruptcy, and we've been running it ever since. In 2006, the Bardavon was approached by the UPAC board to take over that theater because it was going bankrupt. We did an engineering study of the building and recognized that it needed millions in repair and renovation, but we also saw the benefits to the community to having a working theater in Midtown. So despite the challenges, we did take it over. We've raised and spent over $10 million restoring and preserving UPAC. Not one dime came from the county. We increased attendance at the venue from under 10,000 people a year to over 60,000, including 10,000 children, mostly from low-income families. UPEC serves everybody. It's city folks, rural people, tourists. We're not a rich organization or a luxury item, but we are an anchor and an economic engine for Ulster County. We have 21 full-time people, 15 of whom are currently furloughed and working 1 to 3 days a week to maintain our operations at the two theaters and their health insurance premiums. Our pre-COVID $3.6 million annual budget is comprised of approximately 50% box office earned income and revenue, and 50% from very hard to find annual donations. We see just under $200,000 a year from approximately 1,800 member households. That accounts for about 10% of our donations. Our annual economic impact in Ulster County is nearly $3 million, and that does not include artist fees or staff payroll or box office income. That $3 million is a result of filling every restaurant in Kingston 50 times a year, hotel stays, trips to gas stations, even bars. UPAC co-founded the Midtown Arts District, MAD, which is actively helping to transform the perception and reality of Midtown Kingston. UPAC has ongoing collaborations with the city of Kingston, the school district, several school districts really throughout Ulster County, the Kingston Library, Radio Kingston, the Woodstock Film Festival, Ulster BOCES, Kingston Kids, Harambe Kingston, the Center for Creative Education, O Positive Festival. And last year we began an intern program with the county's Restorative Justice Center. We annually admit thousands of low-income families for free to all of our events. And we also send artists from all genres into schools for free to all, for powerful, empowering residencies. They're transformative for these kids. And since COVID, we have so far adapted two of our arts and education programs into virtual performances, one dealing with racism in America, the other an exploration of Mexico's Day of the Dead. We're offering these performances free to every school district in the two counties and every member of our community. We already have thousands of reservations and are actively creating additional virtual education programs for 2021, including hip hop theater, world of dance, and big band jazz. As a result of COVID, we've been closed since March 13. We project a nearly $2 million budget revenue shortfall in 2020 and another million or more in 2021. At the county's request from the beginning, the $25,000 annual grant we receive has always gone towards helping to pay the $50,000 annual UPAC utility expense, gas and electric. That annual utility expense continues despite the COVID closing of UPAC. And that $25,000 is actually the second largest direct grant we get directly for UPAC. Cutting county support for UPAC puts us in danger, along with all of our collaborators and all who benefit economically, educationally, artistically from what we do. We do not have a reserve fund. We are hoping to begin outdoor performances in late spring and summer 21. And the hope is to reopen a UPAC in the fall, but you know, nobody knows. I do urge you to budget us in full in 21 with the contingency that if the county does not receive state or federal stimulus support, which I know you desperately need, I'd again be cut by 50%. The hope is that when the county does finally totally reopen, we want to have UPAC there, strong, ready to continue. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? Legislator Gavaris.
So I'm struggling to understand, if the theater is closed, how do you have the same expense for utilities as you would on a normal year? If 50,000 is that number?
Because it's a huge building that has to be heated, in particular in the winter. But yeah, the bill, you know, it's a good question for Central Hudson, but no, our bills don't really dramatically change, to be honest with you. When we're full up, you know, on a weekend, we're perhaps putting, 100 lights up, but for only for a couple of hours. So the normal day-to-day, I mean, we're still operating. You know, we still go to the office. We still operate. We still actually have to run all of our systems on a regular basis, from plumbing to air conditioning to, you know, everything, because we can't let it sit. So on a regular basis, we're running our systems to, not as much obviously as if we had a show, but still, those are the bills. I can show those to you guys if you'd like. I mean, I think I submitted those in May, yeah, for the last go around in this past spring or summer. But yeah, I can resubmit.
Legislator.
It's a huge structure. So, you know, it takes a lot.
How many square feet, Chris?
Oh, I don't know. It's, you know, 50,000, 60,000 at least for the theater. And then, you know, there's other office space. Like I said, I mean, we do have to, you know, there have been stories of people going back into office buildings, et cetera, that weren't maintaining their systems. And that's, you know, that's how Legionnaire's disease develops. It's a scary thing. So, yeah. Plus, we have a brand new system there, so, which is a good thing. But it still needs to be run.
Legislator
HVAC.
Haynes. Yep. Thank you.
So at least a portion of this funding, if not all, will be going towards utilities.
Yep.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Lynn,
there's one phone number I want to get.
Oh, sure.
To the caller, that's 845-706-0602. Can you please identify your name for the record? Caller from 845-706-0602. You are on mute though.
Was it *6 to unmute?
*6, there.
I'm sorry, it's Mary Waro.
Oh, hi, Mary. Thank you.
Mary.
Hello.
Welcome. Okay.
Thank you.
So next we have soil and water. Adam?
Okay. Thanks for having us. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with everyone. Let me see here. So for anybody unaware, Soil and Water District was created in 1965 by an act of the legislature, then the Board of Supervisors. And we're also a political subdivision of county government. So we're a little bit different in terms of our organizational structure. And we are created to really help with agriculture and water issues within the county, especially in the post-Dust Bowl eras and whatnot. So the main strength really of the Soil and Water District that separates us a little bit from other county agencies or entities is that we can work on private property with public dollars, whether it's federal or state fund or even local dollars. So if you think of somebody like Department of Public Works who may be restricted to a right-of-way, Soil and Water Districts traditionally can work outside of those areas, which is why we do a lot of work on farms or within waterways that may affect public or private infrastructure. Our main areas of operation, and I'll try to keep this short, are really agriculture, water resources, mostly surface water, but certainly some of the programming and projects will have a positive benefit on groundwater, and then technical assistance. And I'll expand on each of these a little bit and provide some examples of the work that we do currently. So on the agricultural front, we are partnered and co-housed with Natural Resource Conservation Service, which is a federal agency under U.S. Department of Ag to do agricultural work within the county. We also work closely with Cornell Crop Extension of Ulster, who you'll be hearing from later, and coordinate with them pretty regularly in terms of our programming, making sure we're not duplicating services, things like that. One of the benefits that we provide to the producers of the county is that we do have on-staff certified crop advisors, so they can provide recommendations that increase crop yields. We also work with nutrient management planning, which helps farms dial in their nutrient needs to optimize yield, but reduce potential runoff and potentially harm, aquatic resources of the county. A lot of that work is completed and falls under what we call the AEM framework, which is just agriculture environmental management. And this is a framework that helps farmers and producers make common sense, cost-effective, and science-based decisions to help meet business objectives while protecting and conserving the state's natural resources. So farmers work with local AEM resource professionals at the Soil and Water District to kind of plan, implement, and evaluate these conservation practices and systems that can address environmental risks on the farm. It's completely voluntary. We're not a regulatory entity in any aspect. We look for farms to come to us that have an interest. We do walkthroughs on the farms. We identify any potential area where we might be able to help them. And then we potentially implement a project. So one of those that we're currently working on and in the process of implementing in the next couple of weeks is an on-farm secondary containment facility, which is essentially a fancy way of saying fuel storage. So farms use a lot of diesel. We're working with this particular orchard to create really the Cadillac of farm refueling sites that would potentially contain any spills, given that they're on some pretty sandy soil that is well drained. They're sitting up on a hill that drains down to a wetland. So we're providing, in this sense, 80% of the funds for that project, with the farm bringing the 20%. So we offer a really good kind of return on a farm's investment through the programming that we can tap into through the state or federal level, and then sometimes local. In the water resources realm, we are well-versed and do a lot of work in terms of diagnosing stream instability and then providing recommendations at no cost to help mitigate issues and achieve essentially a balance within a stream channel. So you might think of it in terms of like, if we see an eroding site, what are the causes of that erosion? What can be done to mitigate that erosion? What are the threats, whether it be to a bridge or properties, somebody's property? In order to do this, we also have on staff certified professionals in erosion and sediment control. They're sometimes actually the trainers who to put on these trainings so that other entities and individuals within the county can maintain their certification. So that's a program that we typically offer annually. A little bit more complicated under the age of COVID since it's oftentimes in person, but we're looking at ways that we could deliver that training and maintain this credentialing online. So on the water resource side, we're also partnered with Cornell Cooperative Extension and New York City DEP for the Ashokan Watershed Stream Management Program, which some of you are aware of. That's in the northwest corner of Ulster County and deals with the upper Esopus Creek. So in that work and in our capacity, the Soil and Water District has implemented large-scale stream restoration projects that have a water quality benefit. And we've started to quantify and assess that benefit through partnerships with US Geologic Survey, who's been able to monitor our projects and show, in fact, that we are having a positive impact on water quality in terms of reducing things like sediment and water quality issues within the upper Esopus watershed. We also participate in assessments and monitoring. So that's actually soil and water staff out walking every linear foot of the streams, addressing any issues that they see, creating geodatabases of geospatial information so that it can be used in planning processes, and then distilling all that down into accessible management plans that the landowners that are streamside landowners or even the municipalities can use to either pursue funding from us or other entities that may be offering funding that could help with any of the issues. The other program that we run is a riparian buffer program, which has implemented several miles of stream restoration projects to improve riparian buffers within the Esopus Creek watershed. And really I think the takeaway from the work that we've done that's so kind of confined to the upper Esopus and the talks that, you know, Jared and Department of Environment and us have been having is how can we take some of these lessons and expand it out of the watershed and apply it in the rest of the county. That's really what we've been looking at in these next couple of years is how can we do that? How can we get that knowledge outside of the watershed and use that effectively? The other area that we're really involved in is what I call technical assistance, and that breaks down into two programs, MAP, which is a municipal assistance program, and LAP, which is a landowner assistance program. Now, very catchy names there. So an example of the MAP or the municipal assistance program, which is at no cost to the municipalities is we were contacted by Department of Public Works for a bridge that they'd applied to design funding for Cornell through their SMIP program up in the Ashokan watershed. They received the funding from us, but then there was this question as to whether or not the bridge designer was adequately addressing sediment issues. So soil and water staff were able to go out and collect sediment data, run an analysis and look at the ability of the stream and that bridge that's being proposed to actually have a positive impact on sediment dynamics through that reach. And we did that working in partnership with the Department of Public Works. So oftentimes soil and water can be complementary to the existing entities or the existing county departments. We work really closely on the municipal assistance side with the local highway departments as well, whether it's addressing any road stream crossing issues, stream instability, flood issues, those type of things. And the other program that I mentioned is the landowner assistance program, which really is just technical assistance to landowners. It might have to do with invasive species on their property. It could have to do with bank erosion. It could be water quality, pond site investigations, a whole host of things that might have to do with water resources that we get reached out to on, you know, a daily or weekly basis. And we provide this technical expertise and recommendations to them at no cost. So in terms of the funding that the county's provided to us over the years, it amounts to about a third of our operational funding. We get the rest either through our contract with DEP for the stream program, and then also through the state. So those are the three entities that are really the main funders for the Soil and Water District. When I go back and have looked at what that return on investment has been for the county, it's varied from about 20 to 30 to 1, depending on the year. So really, it was a really compelling and good bang for the buck in terms of the county dollars that have been allocated to the districts in the past. And that really pays off in terms of, one, these technical assistance programs that we can provide, but also the implementation projects that we're able to undertake, which in some years has amounted to, you know, multi-million dollars of work, whether it's through city and federal funding. So that's really what I have in terms of my spiel, and I'm happy to answer any questions that y'all might have about what we do and what we're looking to do and why this funding is so important to us to kind of keep the lights on and keep the staff happy.
Legislative Walter, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Trying to wrap my head around what my question is. So you've presented us with an amount that is more reflective of what our reduced amount, as opposed to reflective of what you've originally asked for and asked for many years.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm just wondering if you could talk about, I imagine you're not hitting, or maybe you are, like, are you helping as many farms as you want to be helping? Are you dealing with as many streams as you are dealing with? And the sort of reasoning behind reducing what your ask is, was it because you just managed to identify with other sources you can actually do what you're doing? Or are you actually going to be doing less in our county as a result of the reduced amount?
Yeah, thanks. We acknowledge the situation that's facing the county, and that's really where that number came from. You know, listening to the Ways and Means meetings over the past several months and participating in a couple of them, we know how dire the outlook had been, and that's really just a reflection of that. We don't plan to reduce any of our services, and we haven't done that this year. What we would be doing is kind of operating at a loss this year, knowing that we have some fund balances that we can tap into that would help us get through that. So I think if I remember correctly on the budget that was submitted to y'all, it shows about a $50,000 that we'd be operating kind of in the red over the next year. And that's really just a reflection of saying, you know, like, we understand where the county's at and we're willing to, you know, sacrifice a little bit on our end in the hopes that once we get through this period, we'll be able to ask for our full funding back, because really we require that funding to not only support the current staff, but if we want to do some of the things that we've talked about and actually be able to bring in additional dollars, you know, it would be good to increase the staffing at least by another staff member who could help tap into some even additional grant opportunities and whatnot and bring in more money for the county or for the county's producers. So that's kind of the long-term picture. You know, we're willing to get by this year and in 2021 with a little bit less in anticipation for hopefully getting back to normal later on.
Thanks. Can I just ask, maybe not now, but if you can eventually get to us, I'd like to have a sense of like how many farms you help and how many streams you work on, just so that we have some sense of what the impact of those dollars. But thank you.
We could do that. So we've gone through the similar dialogue with Energy and Environment last year, and what we had decided would be a good way to maybe address some of those concerns was for the state, we actually submit an annual plan of work that looks ahead at what type of projects and where we're going to be involved on an annual basis. It's a big document that probably provides more detail than is really needed by either of those committees. So I kind of distilled that down, and I would just say that that's probably a good place to start. And I would just start submitting that with our annual request, because we typically, I think that's due up to the state by the end of the month, actually. So the timing seems to correspond well to this process. And
so, you know, Adam, that sounds great. Could you provide it for this year and for what you're planning for next year?
Yeah, I can do that. So I'm still wrapping up what would be for next year, but I'll get that to you as soon as possible. I can get you the current year's plan. Yeah, as soon as, you know, later this evening. So
great. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, Adam.
Appreciate it all.
Okay, next we have Jared Cornell Cooperative.
Hello, everybody. Adam was gracious enough to spend a lot of time on the Shokan Stream Management Program, so I'll spend more time on the value of agriculture in Ulster County. Hi, everybody. Jared Bono, Executive Director, Cornell Cooperative Extension. I'm going to go all the way back to Lincoln when he started the land grant system. Essentially, states gave land to universities in exchange for those universities to give back to the communities. And what that means is Cornell does some of the cutting edge research on the planet for agriculture and other things. And we extend that research to the communities. At the same time, we inform the future research at Cornell. We're really lucky to have, I think, the premier land grant institution on the planet. Unique to New York in terms of the cooperative extension system is also that every county has its own association overseen by a local board of farmers and business people and stakeholders. So the cooperative part of cooperative extension describes the investment by federal, state, and county resources. So your appropriation to us gets matched by state and federal funds, pretty much one-to-one, depending on how we count the fringe and the different components that come in. And then we write grants to add value to those to the tune of about 8-to-1 in terms of your appropriation. Specifically, you fund specialist salaries in agriculture and 4-H youth development. The first extension agents came to Ulster County in 1913. That was an ag agent. And shortly thereafter, there was a specialist for home economics and 4-H youth development. And that stays what you fund today. Now we have 30 staff and almost 300 enrolled volunteers. We work across all of the research components that Cornell does for New York: agriculture, environment, health, and youth development. Extension professionals have evolved since 1913. Now in the age of information, our agents are much more specialized and are doing applied research in Ulster County. For example, our agricultural team lead is one of New York State's grain experts. So they work on trials for finding what grains can be grown back in the Hudson Valley, because we don't grow very many grains anymore, to support sustainable food systems and for brewers and bakers all over the county to get local grains. Also, we have some of the New York State's, maybe the Northeast's most advanced apple, grape, and hemp research happening right here at the Highland Research Lab, which is composed of Cornell faculty and CCE extension specialists. Your investment in us paid off in 2020. In March, we moved quickly to online services, as well as providing some safe in-person consultations. Many of our staff were exempt from the stay-at-home orders because we work in the food systems. So back when all the store shelves emptied, people turned to local trusted sources of food, and we helped facilitate a lot of those connections with the food system and farms, and then answer a lot of that uncertainty that was happening then. So our specialists actually developed the guidelines for the UPIC operations that are now used across New York State. We have distributed over 2,000 gallons of hand sanitizer and 3,000 masks to 150 local farms, and we continue to do so. We worked with our state and county partners to develop a farm worker health program to keep migrant labor safe and healthy. And the Cornell Institute for Food Safety was the source of information in the spring when everybody was trying to figure this out. They were the ones using the extension system and the research to put it together to tell us how we keep our food safe and our farmers healthy. So we were one of the early agencies to bring back in-person programming. We have held over 40 events in terms of environment with over 650 participants. We've worked with 50 plus municipal officials this year on things like flood risk, stream management, climate resilience. I'm happy to say that across all of our programs, we've had no COVID transmissions. And that includes across CCE, New York State, with all the 4-H summer camps this summer that were held across the state, we've been able to do it without transmitting any COVID. Demand for our services has increased exponentially. At least in terms of agriculture alone, we're getting 50% more calls and requests for information than we ever did before. So we've always provided support for economic development in terms of large commercial apple growers, farm breweries, small farms. Our new farmer classes were always at capacity, but now the demand is through the roof. We held online course for backyard chicken growing, and we had 300 registrants and had to close it down. Backyard pigs was at like 600 registrants. This year alone, our ag team conducted 528 field visits, fielded 2,500 phone calls, and over 19,000 emails. These are from farmers, existing farmers, and new potential farmers about starting businesses and growing food here. Everybody wants to grow food in the Hudson Valley. Everybody wants local food now. And it's lovely to see. We need to maintain that and keep it going. We've held 100 events with 5,000 plus people just in terms of agriculture. And demand for 4-H is also at a high. We held an outreach event in Saugerties last month and 45 families showed up over the course of an afternoon because parents are in need of alternative education for the kids. So with all the changes that you guys are seeing, we see that farms are a larger part of our recreation and our food system. Honestly, we're struggling to meet the demand. I've mostly overcome a $100,000 revenue gap this year, but I face about a $95,000 gap for 2021. So I'm asking you to invest in agriculture, in us and Soil and Water. Honestly, we're your ag line for the county. At the 2020 level, because we have huge demand and my state and federal sources of funding are very uncertain. Right now I'm looking at one layoff, one major program is closing now, but I'm able to keep a lot of it going because we've reduced costs by about $90,000 this year. We'll continue to do that next year. And also Cornell has stepped up and is channeling federal funds in to some of the associations, but it's not enough. I really need the county appropriation. Just to wrap it up, the value of agriculture in Ulster County is $55 million a year. That's farm gate produce. That's not value add. That's not anything that's processed. That's not agritourism or agritainment. So we know that the economic impact is many, many times that. So I would ask that you invest in CCE and Soil and Water so that we can continue to keep the farm and food systems going with all the support that we give. I would invite this committee, along with Adam, we would like to invite you out to see some of the programs. The Legislative Programs Committee would always hold one of their meetings annually at our office or one of our programs. Last year, we were down at the Hudson Valley Research Lab in Highland, which is doing cutting edge work to keep our apple growers in business. So I'm sure we can find a way to do it distanced or remote or otherwise. And then you can see where, you know, you meet the staff, you meet the farmers, you meet the future farmers who you support through your appropriation.
Great. Thank you, Jared. Do we have any questions? Well, Legislator Guevarez, please.
I just more because I'm inquisitive and I have a curiosity. Why does Ulster County not grow grain anymore, especially looking at Legislator Cahill's screenshot there, he's got seal, which has grain on our seal. I just curiosity.
Well, I mean, the food system used to be local. It went global and we didn't do that anymore. The economics didn't make sense.
Okay.
Now it makes sense to go back because things like New York Grown and Certified mandate that in a few years, if you want to say you're New York Grown and Certified producer of beer or whatever happens to be, you have to get up to 80% of your product in New York. Those grains weren't grown. We were importing from Canada and other places. So we're getting back to that seal now.
I didn't know if it was an environmental issue that it's not conducive to growing grain. If that was the reason, that's what sort of why I was asking.
So you said that you've been doing a lot more virtual online seminars and classes and the volume has you've seen an uptick. Do you have a sense of, what percentage increase in activity, requests, programming, that type of stuff you're doing currently?
Yep. So we're working on the report for 2020 now, but just talked to the ag team today and they were saying at least a 50% increase in all channels across, you know, whatever messaging we get on social media, the calls and the emails. At least 50%. In terms of our online registration for classes, it's hard to tell. They're orders of magnitude larger than the in-person classes we were doing.
So you're getting more people coming online than you were.
Yes. And some of those are out of county, some of those are surrounding counties. We always prioritize Ulster residents, but we don't turn anybody away. If you come from Orange, we share across all the associations. Mm. We are a statewide system. Mm. But yes, 600 people want to know how to do pigs through our small farms course. That's amazing.
It sure is. Any other questions? Okay, Jared, thank you so much. Appreciate your time today. Okay, now we have the Dispute Resolution Center, and I believe that's Donna. There you are. Hi, Donna.
Hi, thank you for having me and to be able to talk about the program. I'm with the Dispute Resolution Center, which houses the CASA program, which is court-appointed special advocates. And what we do is we monitor children that are in foster care, and it's monitored by volunteers. And what they do is they take care of one family. They follow everything that's been court ordered for them, make sure that they're doing their parenting classes, they're seeing their therapist, they're, you know, doing their drug treatment, anything that the court has said that they have to do in order to have their children returned to them. And they can do all that because, as with caseworkers with the department, they may have 15 to 20 cases. Our volunteers have one case that they monitor. And we've been able to develop a really good relationship with Family Treatment Court. So that is where the need is, because especially with COVID, drug addiction has skyrocketed. So children are being removed. So that's, you know, what the program is. We've been in existence in Orange County since 1982. I recently took Ulster County. I've had it now for like 3 full years, and we're working on developing the volunteer, you know, group of volunteers. We had our training all scheduled in our nice new training room, and COVID hit. So we are in the process now of doing it virtually, which is the first time ever to be doing the CASA training virtually. But they visit their families through Zoom. And so we've continued to do what we needed to do through COVID. But it is a challenge, as we all know. But CASA is in three counties, but we're housed for Ulster County in Kingston. And we take care of any family throughout Ulster County, monitoring them, you know, doing whatever we need to do. A lot of times, you know, the families are struggling, really struggling with, you know, they have to be here, they have to be there. So a volunteer can help them organize their schedule. Sometimes they don't even know how to do that because, the family's dysfunctional to begin with, that they've had their children removed. So the volunteer is the constant in the child's life, because caseworkers change, therapists change, teachers change. Everybody's changing. Sometimes they're in two or three different foster homes. The CASA follows the case right to the end until there's, either they're returned to family or they're put up for adoption. So they follow through permanency. So I think that's the most important role that our CASA volunteers have. And that is our program.
Okay, any questions? So, Don, I have one. How many families in a given year are part of your program?
Ulster right now, it's kind of low because a lot of them, the case is closed and the courts have not been, in full swing. But we can usually handle 10 to 15 cases, which is a family. Some may have, I have a case in Sullivan County that has 6 children. So, so it could be just about anything.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, Donna, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Next we have Family of Woodstock, Michael Berg.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for your time. I'm a little bit confused because normally this would only be a discussion about one contract. The agency does not receive a contract from the county for its services globally. It has a large number of contracts, many with various departments, mental health, DSS, probation. This contract relates to a service that we provide, which is authorized and mandated by the family court. So I'm not quite sure why it's a legislative item as opposed to an item that the county pays for as part of its normal paying for services that the county is responsible for. It doesn't matter, I mean, as long as we can get enough money to provide the service, but it just doesn't seem to be consistent with the other contracts that have been discussed tonight.
Oh, that's an excellent point.
That Representative Barthel brought this up in previous years.
And have we gone back to, where else would this program sit?
Wherever the family court, it could be DSS, it could be, I would not be the most expert on the county's structure, but it's definitely part of the family services that are provided largely by the DSS.
Okay. Legislator Bartels.
Yeah, well, on this subject, when I raised this issue during the last budget cycle, I had a subsequent conversation with Commissioner Iaposi, and I think he might have even come to committee briefly. But in my conversation with him, he expressed concern potentially about the possibility of it sitting in social services because of the nature of these services and the nature of the impression of a social worker, social services intervention. But I think that there was a certain amount of agreement that it needs to live somewhere else in the county, not in legislative programs. I mean, it doesn't strike me as a legislative program at all. So I don't know. I'm confused why we're here again, because I feel like we should talk to the executive to determine where this should go and to make sure that they're having the correct conversations. Because and maybe Michael, you could talk a little bit. My understanding is these services are mandated, so the county's going to cover them, going to do them regardless, but the maybe Family of Woodstock's portion of the services first came about in a budget cycle where we weren't funding family to do it, we were doing it in-house. And there was a request to fund family because the work that you're doing, particularly as it relates to this, is with a specialized community and affording the opportunity for people not to be in a more comfortable environment in the situation that they're in versus having to go somewhere else in the county. Whereas if the county and county workers were doing it, there might be more disruption to people's lives. I'm oversimplifying, but either way, I feel like this isn't something that should be running through the legislature. I mean, it's not even something that we can evaluate against what else is happening in the county. So I think we should find the correct place to have this conversation in this budget cycle. Because it's a valuable service that you provide, absolutely. It's just, we're not, it shouldn't be at an annual risk of legislative will. Certainly the entire budget is at an annual risk of legislative will because we can vote any line item up or down as we're approving the budget. But I think that this needs to be redirected to the correct department after a conversation with the executive and the executive's office.
So why don't we schedule that, and then we'll come back to you, Michael, with the outcome of that meeting so that...
I would share that one of the things that I think, Tracy, you're sort of referring to is we'll do these meetings on Sunday. We'll do them over the weekend. A lot of times parents travel a long distance. We'll give extended hours because if a parent's not going to be able to see their non-custodial child The non-custodial parent is not going to see their child for 6 or 8 weeks. In some cases, because of COVID, there was a real loss of connection. And this is really important stuff. I mean, even though it's the non-custodial parent, it's still the parent of that child. And so we're very committed to the service. And we're doing it out of the Hodge Center because it allows us more resources and to work on the weekends as well. We did have a situation where a non-custodial parent would not leave. And so we've made it a rule that we have to have 2 staff on site to protect the individuals involved. But other than that, the program is run very well, and we're very committed to it.
Okay. All right. So, Legislator Bartel.
Can I just ask a question, just because this is jogging my memory from last year's conversation. In a normal circumstance, or if it weren't through the county and family of Woodstock, would the non-custodial parent normally have to pay for this supervision? Or
can you charge?
No, I know you don't charge, but I'm saying
the county is putting that financial burden on the non-custodial parent. The one thing I would say though is that this relationship is a very important one, and I would hate to see a parent not be able to see their child because they couldn't pay. Some of the people that we serve are very poor, but still they're the parents of the children.
No, I'm not asking that, and I'm not making a judgment about that. I'm asking that if the county weren't providing the coverage for this service, would the non-custodial parent be billed?
I don't think we would bill them. I don't know how we would provide the service. We're doing an incredible amount of fundraising to keep the services that we have open. And now with the cuts that we've taken, it's going to be even more. But we do not generally charge people for the kind of service that we provide. And I just don't see us doing that. The county is not investing a very large amount of money in this service. It's only this year going to be $20,000. I think we try to keep it as, I mean, we're only charging you for staff time. We want to keep it as low as cost so that more people can see their children.
I'm sorry if I can just ask one more. And can you remind me how many, that 20,000 covers about how many non-custodial visits?
So far we've done over 90 sessions. We've had 22 families with 33 kids. It was closed for about 2.5 months starting in March, but it's operating fully now. I expect that in a normal year, we would serve probably 160 sessions, 180 sessions. It got cut some this year. And I have to say, there's resistance on the part of some of the non-of the custodial parents to have the visits. You know, they're using COVID as an issue, and it may well be for some, but it's also a way of resisting the non-custodial parent being allowed to see the child.
Legislator Guevaras.
So I have 2 questions. One is just to sort of ask what Legislator Bartels had asked. So let me ask it a little differently. If the county didn't put up the money and Family of Woodstock didn't exist, what would then happen for a non-custodial parent? Would they have to pay for a service?
I think that the county is obligated to provide this service.
Okay.
I don't know whether the county could say, we will only provide it if you pay the cost of it. I'm not expert on that. I don't know.
Okay, so that was my second question, because you said in the beginning, we're mandated or required, and I forget which term you use, to offer the service. So I was going to ask if you could elaborate on what the requirement is and where we go for that, because...
If the family court judge authorizes a visit, we will have to provide that visit. We will try and provide enough visits so that continues to be a relationship between the non-custodial parent and the child.
But that's the services you offer. My question is, what is the legal requirement for the county to perform it? And I'm not arguing that we shouldn't be doing it. I'm just asking the question because I agree with Legislator Bartels. This probably should have been resolved last year and put into this year's budget, because if this is not a discretionary expense, then it needs to be part of the regular budget. And it's not something we're doing because we feel as a legislature we want to offer to the county residents. So where, how do you know if there is an actual legal requirement to offer the service?
I believe that it is the requirement of the family court to provide access to to children for non-custodial parents. I don't know whether you can charge for that service, but I believe that the service is a mandated service.
Okay.
Legislator Bartels.
Yeah, I think we'll have to revisit that with Commissioner Iaposi, because I recall, and I could be wrong, but I recall that having the conversation as it related to the non-custodial parent having to pay in this circumstance, the way that you posed the question more aptly than I did, Legislator Guevaras, in the absence of Family of Woodstock or county funding, for though there are absolutely cases where a family has means and provides for the supervision. And I recall Commissioner Iaposi telling me that sometimes it's just resolved internally, where they agree that the supervision is going to be provided by an extended family member or someone else. It doesn't have to be an appointed person or a third party. It's someone that's agreed upon. But there are some very contentious situations where they can agree, where the two parents cannot reach any consensus about who's going to supervise, and then you have to go outside. And typically, you would have to pay for that service. And there are families with means and those without. So yeah. I recall that it really does come down to an issue of deciding whether or not this is something to spend the money on. And it sounds like a very valuable service to me. I mean, I think we're serving people who couldn't otherwise necessarily afford to provide for that. And I would hate to know that even one child didn't get to see their non-custodial parent because that parent couldn't afford supervision in a custodial dispute with another parent. I mean, it becomes very, very complicated, I suppose. But I would like to have a conversation again with Commissioner Iaposi and then with the executive's office to figure out where this makes most sense. I mean, this is now a service that the county have been providing through Family of Woodstock for a number of years. It's become something I think that is relied upon to a certain degree. So we certainly should, I think we need to avail ourselves of the information and then make some decisions.
I would just acknowledge that in a lot of the circumstances where we provide this service, there is a significant tension between the two parents. Sometimes there's a history of domestic violence, but even where there's not, it's an effort to get them to collaborate and coordinate.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good night. Thank you for
thank
your
you. Time. Next, we have awareness, Marie Schultes.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Okay. Thank you all for all the time you take to do this. Doesn't go unnoticed. So I'm wondering, I put together some quotes from participants in the past that have written letters, and I thought that the time may be better taken if I could screen share. I did send it to the Ways and Means Committee members, so you would have it in your email. But I can certainly share it here and let you kind of hear from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
Okay, Natalie, are you?
Yeah, give me 1 second, Marie. I was not prepared and I will bring that up.
Oh, if you want to just hit screen share, I can share it on mine, whichever's easier. But you just have to give me permission to share the screen. So you can let me know when you're ready, but I will say that it's had the opposite effect with the COVID with our organization, because it's opened up an opportunity for more people to be able to get help and for more past volunteers to help. So if you guys want to start reading and then let me know when you.
This was distributed to everyone's emails, just so you know that.
Okay, why don't, instead of having us read this, if we already have it, we can take a look at it, Marie. So if you could just help us by kind of telling us what you've learned through COVID this year, how it's impacted your program, how many folks you've delivered the program to, that could be real helpful, because I want to use our time productively here. Everybody can go back and read this, but if you could just kind of give us an overview, that would be helpful.
Okay, I just kind of feel everybody's so busy. I don't know how much time everyone is going to have to read. So if you don't mind, I'll just read the first one just to kind of give you an idea, and then I'll go into the rest, if that's all right.
Great.
Okay, so in high school, you usually have your blinders on like a horse attached to a stagecoach. You feel so alone, but little do you know, there's someone standing right there next to you. Marie took my blinders off. Therapists, psychiatrists, doctors, I've been to them all. Stop drinking, take your meds, don't smoke, hold it together. Marie was different. The booklets we'd fill out at every meeting reflected all of my decisions, laid them out in front of me and let me examine them. She didn't shove demands in my ears, then look surprised when I didn't listen. She handed me my mistakes with open ears and let me make the next move. I began to see week to week how terribly often I was drinking. Marie's program allowed for the only person who could actually change me to do just that, and I changed me. I'm over a year sober, and that wouldn't have happened without her. She didn't try to counsel me or persuade me. She made me realize how badly out of hand I was and let me fix things myself. Teenagers hate being told what to do, which is why this program works. She didn't sit me down and try to force me to stop drinking. She made me realize I had an issue and gave me the resources to fix it. And I hope she has the opportunity to help more kids. So I tried to select different situations so that through their words, you could see the different aspects of what awareness does, because I feel like it's a really hard thing for people to wrap their head around, because even the kids who come, they don't expect that. They expect, you know, that they're going to be talked to in the same way they are. And in this non-judgmental atmosphere, it really gives them the opportunity to self-reflect and change their own behaviors. And that's what we see. So at the bottom of that, I've outlined what the awareness program does. So did you want to ask me specific questions, or do you want me to just...
Well, I think it's important for you to share how, you know, what your program does, how it reaches these kids, how many kids you're servicing across the county. So we understand how the money is used to support individuals in Ulster County.
I did include a spreadsheet that broke down 2019 and 2020 so far with the different events, how many contacts were made. Would you want to have her put that on the screen?
Well, we have it. We have it in our OneDrive. We have all that information.
Okay, so last year, between all of the programs that we did, we reached 2,141 contacts. And so far this year, we have 875. We were able to not miss a beat as well when COVID hit, because we immediately started online. So we've had an online program going, started out 2 times a week since last March, and now we're up to like 3, sometimes 4 meetings a week. We are, as I said, able to reach a lot more kids. And for instance, I have, I'm sorry, stop. For instance, I have, 27-year-old that now lives in Oregon who came to us when he was 17. And then he stayed and volunteered with us for a number of years. And now he's back helping lead meetings virtually, as well as staff, as well as we have a 25-year-old that completed the program 2 years ago. He's now back helping. I mean, there's like a countless list. So it's been incredible for us in that respect. The court actually requested that we stay online, because so many times people will say they can't come to the program because of the physical having to get to the site. And the only thing that we are trying to work out that's a challenge is when participants usually come, they have a program guide, and the peer leaders have a leader guide. So trying to figure that out digitally is the challenge right now, because at this point, the courts were closed, so we didn't get the referrals that we usually would have, but we are working with several new people. And one of the things that I was really happy to see was that even after the first meeting, when we were signing out, the person that was on the meeting that had just come for the first time through the virtual said he had never opened up like that before with the other peers that were on the call. So it shows me that we can get that same connection that we had in person, even without pizza, in, you know, in the virtual.
So you said you're getting referrals from the courts. Who else? But now you're getting others. Who else are you getting referrals from now?
Well, we had to finish a bunch of them that were already in the program, like live through the virtual. But so I didn't really have a way to see if it would work. So I get attorneys from lawyers, from different people that have been in the program, will refer other people when they think they need help. So basically, that's what the people that we're helping right now.
Great. Legislator Bartels.
So I was just going to ask, I mean, because you're virtual now, then I assume your expenses, because there's no pizza, have you seen an overall reduction in your expenses?
Yes, in that respect. But the other tricky part is the with the virtual, for instance, if you're going to put youth in breakout rooms, like if I'm in a room and I have several leaders leading, and I'm there to go around and, you know, make sure, see what's going on. So here I have to put them in breakout rooms. So I need a different computer to have on each breakout room to be able to watch the rooms. So right now we haven't been inundated with referrals because of the courts being closed. So that's one of my challenges that I'm trying.